It is truly now my joy to introduce Dr. Terry Thrower. Terry holds a PhD in disability studies from the University of Illinois in Chicago. She has a bachelor's and master's degree in rehabilitation counseling and has lived over 50 years with a disability and a chronic illness. At the age of 3, she was diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, now called juvenile idiopathic arthritis, since no one fully knows or understands the root cause of this condition. An Air Force brat, I can't see her as a brat, but an Air Force brat, Terry lived in some pretty exotic locations while growing up. When she was not in the hospital for many weeks and months at a time, she was outside trying her best to just be a normal kid. At the age of 32, she became legally blind, having lost most of her usable vision following glaucoma surgery. She has endured more than 40 major surgeries in her lifetime. In 2016, suffering from spinal cord compression and losing the ability to use her arms and legs, she underwent an urgent skull to mid-spinal back surgery that permanently immobilized her neck. She and her husband, Greg Thrower, have had many adventures in their 24 years together, including crisscrossing the U.S., visiting China, Mexico, and England as a disability studies scholar. And their latest adventure is moving to the North Georgia mountains and hopefully finding us. Greg's love and care and support have kept Terry going through all the trials that have accompanied this incurable chronic illness. The title of her talk, which she was so very willing to share with us, is called Unruly Bodies, Embracing and Sharing Our Unique Stories. Dr. Terry Thrower. And guava.
And thank you, Gail. Thank you guys for being so welcoming to us. That's why we're here. Okay. So I'm a little nervous. That's okay. And just so you know, I have some slides. I'm going to be working vocally with my husband to help him to move the slides along. And he's going to be also helping me keep time. So thanks for understanding that. So it's not easy to talk about our bodies. We often don't have the language or the space to discuss what are often or frequently unruly, messy, and unpredictable issues about our bodies. So I want to take you on my journey of how I learned to talk about my body. And some of this you've already heard a little bit of in my bio, but I want to point out some of those words. And the first one is normal. When I was 3, I learned that I wasn't normal because I was the only one in my family and the only one that I saw around me who was spending weeks and months at a time in hospitals, or coming home to have physical therapy and wearing braces or wearing splints at night. I was the only one with a body that needed to be fixed by doctors, and that knowledge of being that different led me to understand that there was something wrong with me. But I decided, instead of there being something wrong with me at that young age, I wanted it to be all about my body. So I separated myself from my body. And I allowed doctors to have the purview, to have the knowledge to take care of my body and not me. I was going to take care of me. While I was growing up, I also learned that because I was the only one around going through stuff like this, that it was stressful to talk about it with other people. It created stress in my family to discuss my pain or my emotional needs or the fact that I didn't like what was going on. So I kept that to myself. Bionic. When I was 12 years old, I met a surgeon who told me, let me backtrack a little bit, I'm sorry. Juvenile idiopathic arthritis has, what it does is it inflames the joints, started in my knees, and quickly spread to the rest of my body. It caused my, it is an autoimmune disease that disrupts the cartilage. It attacks its own synovial fluid and cartilage throughout the body. My knees were bent and deformed, and I walked on tiptoes and sort of hunched over throughout my childhood. I also was given a diagnosis of uveitis at the age of 12. Uveitis came along with the juvenile arthritis as an inflammatory condition of the eyes, part of the disease. And at 12, I met a surgeon who told me when I turned 18 and stopped growing, I could have my knees replaced. So what I saw was The Bionic Woman. You guys remember that show, right? And that I was watching it, you know, it's on TV at the time, and that was my dream. I was like, I'm gonna have my knees replaced and I'll be normal. I'll be bionic even. And to me, bionic meant that I would be able to sit cross-legged on the floor like the other girls that I saw in school, or run up and down stairs, or ride a bike like the other kids. That I'd start to look and act like other people. And that dream carried me into my adulthood and through those awkward teenage years. By the time I was 26, I found a surgeon who agreed to replace my knees. But by then, my hips had been damaged enough by the way I was walking and the arthritis that, bonus, he was going to replace my hips as well. So, so yes, I had bionic parts, but my dream of being bionic didn't really happen, because not only did I not get the powers that I saw Jamie Summers have, I didn't really get knees that bent. What I got were knees that straightened, and I walked a little better, I had less pain. All of that was good, but I didn't get my dream. I didn't get to sit cross-legged on the floor or ride a bike. I couldn't even pull my knees underneath my chair to keep them out of the way. But by then, I'd been living with this body and all of my deformities and pain and indifference for so long that it was okay. You know, I'd started to get used to it. And I was working as a vocational rehabilitation counselor. I was getting my master's degree. I moved on. And that was often what I did. I would just deal with things and move on. At 29, I met the love of my life. And actually, we're celebrating our 24th anniversary today. But within 2 years of that, of meeting and marrying Greg, I went in for a routine glaucoma surgery. So I told you that I'd had the uveitis, and it led to glaucoma. The way they treated it caused an additional problem, And I'd had several glaucoma surgeries to keep my vision. And this surgery was supposed to keep my vision as well, but I woke up blind. So now I'm disabled and blind. And I was like, I have no idea how to deal with that. But I, of course, I moved on. But at the same time, I was, it was 1996 at the time. And of course, the Atlanta Olympics were happening. And I was invited to attend the Paralympic Congress. Actually, it was a conference put on by the Paralympic Committee. And this was transformative for me. I walk in and there are all these people that are disabled talking about disability as identity, disability as cool, and disability pride. Do we have the disability pride slide up there? Thanks. So this was a new concept for me. And the other thing was I saw people in wheelchairs dancing alongside able-bodied dancers for the first time. I saw actors with disabilities. I saw artists expressing their experience of their bodies as disabled people in positive ways, in sort of political ways through their art. It was amazing. And through that experience, I found a new calling. So even though I had gone back to work as a vocational rehabilitation counselor, which is about helping other people get jobs, something had shifted in me, and I wanted to explore this disability arts and culture thing. So I set off to get my doctorate in disability studies. Now, disability studies, how many of you understand disability studies? Just make some noise. Not so much. Okay. Disability studies is a bit like women's studies or gender studies. So it's looking at the experience of disability, not necessarily as just a medical or individual experience, but it's putting it in context of other marginalized groups, like women, LGBTQ communities, people of color. So it's exploring the social, political, cultural, economic, psychosocial, all of those issues. And while I was there, I, of course, was interested in disability as an art and culture. And I had a cohort, a community of students and professors with disabilities, as well as artists, disabled artists. And of course, around this time, my right ankle said, hey, you know, this hurts. So I went to see a doctor, because that's what I do. And the doctor told me he could replace that joint, more bionics parts. And I talked to my cohort, and they were like, why would you do that? You know, this was a radical departure from what I had known about getting fixed. And of course I listened, and they said, you could just use a wheelchair. But I was blind, and I was, and you know, fiercely independent, wanted my mobility, and in fact had just applied to receive this beautiful guide dog that I use. And so I was like, how? How do you deal with being blind and in a wheelchair? It was as if they couldn't see me or hear me or experience my, what I was dealing with. And so even in that kind of situation, it's hard to talk about our bodies. And it's hard for people, even though they share similar experience, to even enter that space and empathize with difference in that way. I'm gonna switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit more about disability studies, which borrows a lot from other social movements, including the LGBT community. And they borrow the term coming out. Now, sometimes coming out as disabled sounds a little off, sounds a little strange. So let me explain. This is Techie on the screen. Techie is an artist. She's a dwarf, a little person, 3.5 feet tall, and she's using her crutches, so she also has a disability. But she's not gay. In the course of getting my dissertation, finishing my dissertation, I was working with artists, several artists with disabilities. She was one of them. And she did a performance about coming out as a little person and a disabled person, and I was so puzzled. I was like, it's obvious why. When I talked to her about it, why would you need to do that? And she explained that it was about claiming her identity for herself, you know, sort of making sure that she publicly stated, this is who I am. And in doing that, she claimed her community in a way that says, I'm also part of little people and disabled people. And at the same time, in front of this audience, she was saying, and it's okay to talk about it. Let's talk about it. You can talk about this thing, that this elephant in the room, and we can talk together about our bodies. By the time I completed the PhD program, I was feeling pretty good about accepting myself as a disabled and blind woman with a doctorate, and I was ready to step into my role as a professor of disability studies. And then my body said, hello, as it usually did. You heard a little bit about the spinal cord compression. And it was within months of my receiving my PhD that I started to have symptoms of numbness and tingling in my hands. I was falling a lot. I was having weakness and terrible pain and barely able to function. And the choices were, when I went to see a surgeon, because of course that's what you do, that I could stay like that and probably die within a year or two, first becoming quadriplegic, or have this surgery that completely would immobilize my neck and further reduce my visual field, my ability to sort of compensate for my low vision and my blindness by using my neck, further limit my energy, but I might live. There was still a risk of quadriplegia and death for the surgery, but life was also possible, and so of course we chose that. It's still not easy for me to talk about that. So I think my neck was up there. And now I want you to see my bionic self. Yes? The bionic self. This is all my replaced parts. When I saw this, that too was rather transformative. It sort of said, wow, I've been through a hell of a lot with my body. There's a lot to talk about, but I'm able to function. I'm able to contribute. I'm able to be before you, and I'm so grateful to have another chance at life. I'm so grateful to be able to share my story with you and hopefully come out in a way that invites others to share their stories about their bodies. I've heard wonderful stories up here in the Joys and Concerns today about people's pain, their loved ones, difficulties, disabilities, injuries. We all go through it. We all know about it. But it's often hard to talk about, and it's often still so marginalized that we don't even include it in when we start talking about race, gender, sexuality. it's left off the table. Disability and illness and pain is often left out, but it's so prevalent in our lives. And so one of the things I wanted to leave you with is this quote from Neil Marcus. We have that one?
Yeah.
That disability is not a brave struggle, is that the first one?
Yeah.
Or courage in the face of adversity. Disability is an art. It is an ingenious way to live. And I would suggest that all of living is ingenious. I hope I've opened up the space enough for us to have more discussion about this. And I'm absolutely happy to take questions, try to clarify, and thank you so much. Yeah.
The next doctor's appointment, the next procedure, the next this or that. And they get very much, I think, sometimes overly focused on that. But what you said at the beginning of your talk really struck me, that there's something wrong with their body, but there's not something wrong with them as a person. And I think that's something I would take back to them. There's nothing wrong with them. It's just their body is not working. I think they get so focused on what's not working that they forget to see the parts of themselves that are really working.
Yeah, that's good. But you do get kind of lost in that cycle and start to feel like a burden, and there's this ongoing process of affirming yourself and self-acceptance, which is hard to get to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Words are very important to me, and I'm a member of the LGBTQ community and only came to that realization in my 50s and started to embrace the language.
Mm.
Do you find the term disability to be pejorative?
To be what?
Pejorative.
No. In fact, disability has been, for me, a shortcut, because I do have chronic illness, I have chronic pain. There are so many other worse words. But disability has become not only a shorthand, but as I use the term disabled woman, disabled and blind woman, because what I didn't mention about disability studies is there is a social model of disability. which can be a little complicated, but it takes the issue out of the person's body, at least for political reasons, to say disability is in society, that it's created by the barriers, the attitudes, the environment. So for me, it's a positive term, but not everybody likes it. And I don't want to be language police, so I try not to argue about it. But other people like different abilities, other people like impairments.
Other able is one that I've heard.
Yeah. Yeah. All kinds of ways to use.
Sherry and I, of course, talk about this all the time. And one of the things that we've seen is you almost have to go through this period of aligning yourself with a distinct group because you are marginalized from the greater group, the 90%, right?
Yeah.
And then there comes a time when you want to be known who you are. And that was the problem with what we saw in the PhD program, is they wanted Terry to be inclusive into the group. They wanted her to look like the guy with the wheelchair, you know, the symbol that marks handicapped people. And she was different. She made other choices. Did that remove her from the disability population? No. It was very much a part of her life and her existence, but she chose to do other things to immobilize her life, right? And so it's challenging when we align ourselves with any marginalized group, when we step outside of that marginalized group and say, okay, I know I'm a part of this group, but I'm also a part of me. I am me. I am that unique individual. And to be able to appreciate and present and understand that unique individual, that is a challenge in our society. When we look at the person next to us and we say, I want to know you through, you know, your life experience, your disabilities, your alignment with the LGBTQ community.
Your intersectionality, too.
Yeah.
Because I didn't mention, and this is obvious, but disability is one of those marginalized groups that anyone can enter at any time.
And it's huge. I mean, it's 20% of the current United States population claim to have disability. They identify with that community.
So I can't see any of y'all over here. So if you have questions, just speak up.
We're watching.
Okay. Yeah.
Terry. I can't remember if this was in my sociology or my philosophy class, but we talked about marginalized people. And one of the powers that I really appreciate you talked about coming out as a disabled person, because it puts a link remote when you're saying it also. But then it reminded me of this class where we talked about two of the nastiest words in the English language is nigger and queer.
Mm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things talking about, Diane brought up a minute ago, is the way these words are used and how people reject them. Sometimes people actually get taken back. Like NWA is a rap group, Niggers with Attitude. They wanted to take that word and take the power away from it. And there's a publication called Queer. Queer Times? Is it Queer Times? The same thing, they wanted to get the power back. They want to take the word back. So that thing is very, very powerful of coming out when you use this, take the ownership of this term and make it your own.
Right.
And of course, the same thing exists in the disability community. Crip. Crip is the word, you know. It's being claimed as being crip culture. And it's another one of those alliances.
It's a reclaiming of the bad words, right?
Allison. I just wanted to say, I'm teaching a course to stand up, apparently. And I one of the assignments that my students have, there's about 21 students in the class, and I have to do this twice. They're supposed to interview somebody from basically a different walk of life than theirs.
So, okay.
You know, somebody who's different than them. And yeah, I laid out some kind of guidelines and instructions on what would be a good person to choose, somebody who's different from you on this dimension, on this dimension. And one of them is disability, and out of, I've read 41 papers now, because they had to do this twice, nobody selected disability as an option. And I wonder if it's because of what you're talking about, it being so difficult and uncomfortable for somebody who's not disabled to have that conversation with somebody.
Yeah, and there's kind of silencing that we do by not talking about it or not tagging it on to, you know, color and gender and sexuality. So it's hard. I think we just need more exposure. You know, we need to have those spaces where we can talk about it openly and not be afraid to make mistakes. That's the other thing. People are worried about hurting somebody's feelings or not using the right terms, and I think we have to sort of let go of that stuff and just be open to talking about our lives and our bodies and our disabilities.
Yeah, and there's something, you saw the slide of someone with three people. One was Terry, one was another small person who lives.
Little. Little person.
Who is also a college professor at Wright State. The guy in the middle is an actor, and he is on a series currently called Loudermilk. And these people are very unique, very accomplished. They're, and yet, all of them identify as being Julie and Matt, not the guy with the short arms. He has short arms, and you can talk about that, and he doesn't mind, and he's not offended. It's part of him and part of his life experience. To deny that aspect of him is to deny a huge part of who he is. But to be afraid to talk about it is just as bad. One of the things that we've seen in Blairsville, and we've talked to people about, you don't see people with disabilities in Blairsville. And the people that we have talked to that enter other people's homes, their contractors and the like, they have told us, they shared with us that Appalachia requires that you be self-sufficient. And if you're not self-sufficient, it's a sign of weakness. And so oftentimes people with disabilities are not taken out into the larger world because there is an embarrassment. There is also a fear that either that family member will be ignored by others, or will be ostracized, or will be made fun of.
Right.
And so it's this other population that becomes invisible, as opposed to seeing that odds are, you know, whoever you are, if you live a long and healthy life, you're going to have disabling conditions before you die. This is part of the experience of being alive.
Yeah.
Are there other comments or questions? Alicia.
I don't even know how to say what I've been thinking about. My mother married my father straight out of high school, and they were stationed in Camp Lejeune, which was later discovered to have poisoned water, which really messed my mother up. She was already disabled by the time I was born, and then my brother and I were both disabled, and it wasn't until I started school that I even realized that there was anything different about us at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was 10 years old before I realized not everybody spends weeks at a time in the doctor's office. Well, not weeks, but like every week, Mom had physical therapy. I had physical therapy. My brother had speech therapy because he was born with hearing problems.
Wow.
And yeah, it was just.
So it was just part of your life.
Yeah, it was never even a thing until I started school. And then I realized every other kid was going to PE and I was being sent to physical therapy.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. It's not a common experience because it's more common to be the only kid in the family with a disability or the only individual. That's more common, but it does happen, you know, where there are multiple people. So thank you.
And the funny thing is about your experience is that was your normal until the larger community started saying, no, you're not. You know, it's something else. I had a serious experience as a child that her normal was somehow distorted, and she was no longer a part of a larger community. She was no longer a part of a smaller community. She then again was just her.
Other comments?
Another thing we had was another thing
in my family was a lot of us have invisible disabilities. There's a lot of neurological and mental illness in my family. My brother and my nephew are both autistic, and there's reason to believe I'm on the spectrum too. And yeah, it's weird.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Oh. He said one more.
Okay. Thank you for talking with us today. It's interesting, you know, listening to you talk and what it brings back for me and one particular incident. When I was a long, long time ago, when I was a young man, I got involved with this group in the New York metropolitan area. They had meetings at a community center, and the group was called ACT UP. Although I was not a part of that group, I was very interested in finding out what it was all about. And it was basically a lot of angry, angry gay men who came together to bring out this whole HIV and AIDS epidemic and talking about it.
Right.
And one of the things, it's talking about words, I'm still going to be a little all over the place today. Casey was saying about the N-word and the word queer. The N-word, I have issues. I can't spit it out of my mouth. But queer, I can. And in that group, this guy, and it just stays in my memory, he said, we have to take the word queer back and make it a positive. And not make it this taboo, quiet word like, that person's queer, like it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
So I remember him saying, you know, this phrase, we're queer, we're queer, get used to it.
Yeah.
And so it made it like, yeah, no big whoop, you know. And it was all about coming out and talking about things. And that at that moment was HIV and AIDS and bringing it to the light, and we shouldn't talk about it in hushed tones or and the same thing with people with disabilities. We shouldn't be afraid of that. We should be able to walk up to somebody and say, how you doing, and what's your deal, you know, what's your story.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's
what happened to you?
I'm always big on getting to know people. So one thing I got from that meeting many, many years ago, and it was a phrase that maybe a lot of people here know and understand, and I'm using it more and more on social media, and that's the phrase, silence equals death. And that was a phrase that at that time in my life, at that meeting, I learned about. We had little buttons, and it was about, if we don't talk about something, we're going to die. And that then had to do with HIV and AIDS and so on and so forth. And today, with what's going on politically, and you know, it's a scary time we live in, and you know, we have these weird moments in our household where we'll discuss, you know, is it ever going to come to the point where we're going to, you know, because we're part of a different community, are we going to be like rounded up and put in a cage and whatever, you know?
Exactly.
And we have to talk about these things because we have history in the world when all these people were executed, Jewish people were executed, whoever else, gypsies, whatever, gays.
People with disabilities.
And people with disabilities for being inferior, what was felt inferior.
Right.
And so just do away with them, and that's the cure. And we need to talk about it because I think back then, I'm not sure, but there was a lot of silence.
Yeah.
And silence equals death. So we really have to embrace differences in people and
talk about them.
And talk about them.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
We have one more, Diane. Last one.
This is great discussion, y'all.
Sorry, Terry, I
can
just stay up.
It's okay.
Have you had much international experience? That's my question. I'll tell you why I asked that question. My son lives in China. He's lived there 10 years, and I've gone to visit him 5 times. And in China, if you belong to a group that's not recognized as mainstream society, you don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Like second daughters don't have an ID. They can't go to school. They can't. It's like they don't exist. And I was on the subway with him in the city, because he lives in Beijing, and he handed me some Chinese money that I never knew what it was worth, but he said you have to pay your tax, and entering one end of the train car we were in were two little people, and they walked the length of the car.
Yeah.
And people put money in there, in this basket that they had with them. And my son said, little people don't exist in China. The Chinese government will tell you there are no little people. So this is the only way they can support themselves. Then they get off the other end of the car, and the transit police take half of what the car.
Oh, wow.
And I was horrified. And it's like, you know, people talk about, let's, you know, we have China being great economic opportunity, blah, blah. There's a lot of not good stuff going on in China that people are just not talking about.
Yeah, so I haven't been to China since 2000. Greg and I went. And I was there. It was a people's ambassador thing, and I visited these schools where there were deaf students, like a segregated school, and there was a sheltered workshop kind of thing in another city, and or there were people with disabilities on the streets begging. So that was what I saw, and I was like, okay, this is not really cool. They're not really integrated. But that's what we got. So yeah, hopefully it's changing. I don't know. Doesn't sound like it.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you.